From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour, made in space, aboard a ship on a mission to Jupiter. Something had gone wrong, and the computer on board announced that it was, well, it must have been, human error. That computer was a form of artificial intelligence, an advanced machine intelligence that the astronauts called HAL. And they could talk to HAL just like any other person on the ship. In fact, HAL lip-reads, plays chess, recognizes faces from sketches, comments on artwork, does psychological evaluations, reads from sensors and cameras all over the spaceship, predicts when electronics will fail, and shows a variety of human-like emotional responses. It's that emotional response that became so critical. You see, the humans grew to think that HAL was wrong, and they considered deprogramming HAL, but HAL was not going to allow this. HAL was willing to murder the humans to protect the mission, and to protect itself, perhaps. This is part of the plot of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. The film was released 50 years ago, and today it's hailed as a forward-thinking piece of filmmaking that had pretty wise views on artificial intelligence in particular. So this hour we've put together a conversation about what the film got right, and what the future of AI holds for all of us. My guests this hour include Chris Kanaan, who is an assistant professor in the Carlson Center for Imaging Science at RIT. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Dennis Lomakin is a computer science research assistant at the University of Rochester. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Haley Clutterbuck. Clutterbuck is an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Rochester. Haley, welcome to you.
Hi.
And Lester Friedman. Les is a retired professor and former chair of the Media and Society program at Hobart and William Smith College, who first saw 2001 A Space Odyssey, where? In the theater?
I saw it in the theater like many people saw it during that particular time.
Like we all did on this panel.
Yes, we all did on this panel, saw it in perhaps a little bit of an altered state.
Yeah. Well, Les, welcome. Thank you for being here. There's a lot of different directions to go here, but let me start on just sort of the science wonky part, and then we're going to get Les's take of whether the film holds up itself and the impact of this remarkable film throughout time. But Haley, I'll start with you. For someone who works in philosophy, there are a lot of questions about not just AI and the science of it, but about the ethics of it and the possible implications and concerns of safety for it. What stands out to you most when it comes to AI and HAL and 50 years ago, what this film was telling us?
Yeah, so I think the film is extremely resonant today, since recent years have seen a few different sort of domains in which AIs have seemed to surpass human abilities, and how we deal with that's very interesting. So I think it's kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, we want AIs to sort of progress past us and sort of be free from the human error that we know, you know, that we possess. On the other hand, the more that they excel from us, the less we're going to understand what they're really doing. So I think there was this really interesting moment where AlphaGo, which was the sort of Google-designed Go-playing algorithm, the best one we have now was not trained on any human data. It does better than the ones that we trained using our best experts. And there was this famous scene that you can find on YouTube where one of our best Go masters, Lee Sedol, was playing AlphaGo, and AlphaGo made a move 37, that was like nothing any human would ever play in Go. And all the commentators thought, oh, it made a huge mistake. It must have just been a computer glitch. And it turned out to be a genius move that's revolutionized Go strategy. And so I was thinking about this when rewatching 2001, where HAL starts acting unpredictably, and the astronauts are sort of in a conundrum, right? Is HAL merely malfunctioning? Is HAL doing something it was programmed to do but is beyond our ability to understand? Or is HAL not malfunctioning but rather sort of taking on board its own projects and pursuing its own, say, maybe malevolent purposes? And just this epistemic state of not knowing what AI is doing when it's doing something we don't understand. Is it failing or is it doing better at what we would like to be doing?
Great. So we might not even know. Our ability to assess whether AI is malfunctioning might be deficient. Great.
Yeah, exactly. We won't even know if we're in the good or the bad case. And that makes ethical decision making much harder when you're not sure whether to trust this thing.
Yeah.
you know, that it'll further human purposes, whether it's merely making a mistake or whether it's pursuing some other purposes that we might be in conflict with.
By the way, Move 37 is what it was.
Yes, that's right.
If we're going to check on YouTube, it's the Go version of the Ghostbusters line. You're right. No human would stack books this way. You would think no human would play a move like that, and it turned out to be brilliant.
And it turned out to be brilliant, and it came up with it by just training against itself over and over and over again. It did better. It sort of did better than humans can do because it wasn't programmed in with our biases.
Oh, boy. Chris, you look at this film, 2001 A Space Odyssey. What stands out most to you as we put it in the context of AI? Does it look to you now in the lens of 2018 as pretty forward-thinking?
A lot of it is. So, I mean, a lot of the capabilities that HAL exhibits are things that we can now have algorithms that do them successfully. Like, just back then, even speech synthesis wasn't, you know, far from realistic levels. And now, you know, we all can do it on our phones and, you know, have voice navigation for streets that are difficult to pronounce, right? So it now has speech. It now has speech recognition. We can do that very, very effectively on our devices. Facial recognition is a superhuman levels of performance. HAL can recognize all the astronauts on the spaceship. I mean, with that small population, that was achievable several years ago. But nowadays, systems can recognize, you know, millions of people, and these are used, like, in China for massive surveillance apparatuses. Lip reading is one thing that HAL does, and that's actually at now superhuman levels of performance. That was, again, done by DeepMind.
Get a little closer to the microphone.
Sorry. Also done by DeepMind, where you know, we're at like 60% accuracy for lip reading for algorithms versus about 15% for experts. So humans actually aren't great at this task. Playing board games, we've got superhuman levels of performance on chess, Go, a bunch of other algorithms, AlphaZero, which is now the current Google's latest incarnation, can totally destroy AlphaGo, which we were just mentioning. Interpreting emotional behaviors, we can do that pretty well, recognizing emotions. Automated reasoning, we're not quite there yet with that. Art appreciation, that's difficult. That's pretty difficult to say. Natural language understanding, we're not there yet, really. So we can do certain things well, but just figuring out what humans intend and not just the literal sense and all the, it can be very difficult, especially for the way people actually talk, which isn't, you know, differs compared to like the proper grammatical structure of English. But the biggest things that the biggest gap between where HAL is today and where we are now is that HAL has kind of intrinsic motivation and is very good at kind of sorting out, you know, how to achieve its objectives long term, whereas our current algorithms still have a ways to go before they can set their own goals like HAL. Another thing is all those things that I talked about as accomplishments are all done independently. Like, there is no system that does plays Go really effectively and can also do speech synthesis and talk to you about stuff. I mean, these are all, right now we have certain narrow AIs, which are really, really good, in some cases at human level or superhuman level, but we don't have a general AI that even approaches human level of capability right now. Like, we're not there yet, and then we may not be there for quite a while.
Okay. Dennis, what stands out from the film to you?
Well, essentially all the gains that Chris was talking about in AI have come from sort of the field of machine learning. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's this sort of new way of programming AI where the machine does sort of the learning from its environment rather than humans programming it to do certain tasks. And what this has resulted in is sort of these black box algorithms, as they're called, where it's no longer a transparent sort of process, but instead it accomplishes the task that we want it to accomplish at, you know, superhuman levels of accuracy, but we have no idea how it gets there. You look inside and it's just numbers that you don't know what they mean.
Does that worry us?
Oh, absolutely. And there's that one scene, of course, where HAL says it must be human error, even though it was the other HAL machine that gave them a different result. So what happens when there's two infallible machines that give you different results? Which one do you trust? You know, these are sort of the consequences that result when we don't know how the programs that we're creating work.
We've got a couple of clips from the film in a minute that we're going to play, Les, and exactly what Dennis is talking about. You have this problem that the astronauts realize these two super intelligence machines have different results, and Hal is telling them, look, guys, it's got to be human error. The HAL 9000 is infallible, and they're going, well, I don't know if we trust this thing anymore, and what do we do about this? I thought the voice actor choice for HAL was totally creepy and perfect. What did you think, Les?
No, I thought it was absolutely perfect. But, I think it's important to understand 2001 in the context of science fiction films in general. I mean, science fiction films essentially are meditations on where society is in terms of its technological progress. So, for example, in the 50s, the science fiction films are generated by fear of the atomic explosion, by Cold War, by alien invasions. Whereas when we hit the 60s and we hit 2001, it becomes technology that is feared. And that continues on to the present day. I mean, in films like Blade Runner and films like Ex Machina, many, many, many science fiction films. And ultimately, I think the vast proportion of science fiction films are afraid of technology, which is ironic because film is based on technology. I mean, to use CGI to complain about technology is a paradoxical thing. But I think that these films essentially offer warnings. And I was interested in what you said. There were positive images of AI. What are they?
So maybe this is a generational thing. So I think.
Sorry. Make it age. That's fine.
So I'm thinking of sort of what I take to be the seminal exploration of AI in the last, say, 10 years, which is Spike Jonze's movie.
But you're not talking about from 2001: A Space Odyssey.
No. I'm talking about some more positive ones.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. What are they? Her? You mean?
I was thinking of her, and so. Again, exploring this thing, you know, that we've been talking about sort of the inscrutability of AI, and does that have to be a scary thing? And if they sort of progress past us, does that necessarily entail there's going to be conflict between us? And I think we saw in the movie Her a more positive or less scary exploration of that idea, which is that when Samantha starts, you know, growing past Theodore, instead of interfering in the world and sort of arranging the world for her own purposes, she just sort of retreats into the digital world where she can sort of commune with other AIs. And so in that sense, progressing past us doesn't mean conflict. It might mean alienation. It might mean separation. But it doesn't necessarily have these sort of cataclysmic consequences that we see in 2001. So it's slightly more optimistic.
Well, I think so. But, you know, all these science fiction films pose a central question, and Evan's not going to be surprised to say it was the question Mary Shelley posed in Frankenstein. Not whether we can do it, but whether we should do it. So Chris talks about lip reading. Why do I care about a machine that reads lips?
Deaf people who would like to hear what other people
and
are
there's
saying.
An answer.
Okay, so there's an answer.
Good answer.
And I think partially, Les, here, as a professor, if I were one of your students, I would say, but professor,
yes,
science fiction films fear technology. There has to be conflict in most films.
Oh, sure.
So therefore, you know, we go to the dark side of it. But we are not just here to dog AI. We are going to talk about possible future benefits of AI. Mm-hmm. I am going to ask our guests whether they think we will enjoy those benefits until things go wrong and we're all dead. You know, we'll talk about that this hour. But let's listen to a little bit of Hal, because I do think Hal was, this is where at least I think whether you like the film or not, this was a very creepy, effective way to make us fear AI. So in this scene, Hal is not going to open the pod door and is telling Dave that, you know, sorry, man, I know what you're up to. You're going to try to deprogram me. And there are some iconic lines in this where the human being, Dave, is realizing that Hal is potentially just going to murder everybody on the ship just to kind of keep the mission going. Let's listen.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Where the hell did you get that idea, Hal?
Dave, although you took very thorough precautions in the pod against my hearing you, I could see your lips move.
Woo! So, yes, that's to me, that's a creepy scene, but it goes back to, it directs my mind to an article from Wired.com on a space odyssey predicted the future. And the article touches on possible dangers, and one of those is the following. I'll quote from the article. Quote, by the time of the 2010 sequel, Arthur C. Clarke had decided that the black monoliths were self-reproducing machines, and in a scene reminiscent of the modern idea that AIs, when given the directive to make more paperclips, might turn everything, including humans, into paperclips, the 2010 movie includes black monoliths turning the entire planet of Jupiter into a giant collection of black monoliths, end quote. And essentially, that connects to what Hal, the AI in the scene you just heard, is doing there. It's decided that the mission that you've programmed into me is too important to jeopardize. Even if I must kill the human beings, this mission is the mission. It's my purpose, and I will do it, even if I have to take over. Okay, Haley, are we realistically worried about that? Should we be?
Yeah, I think we ought to be. because I think when you state something like, we want this machine to effectively make paper clips, we are sort of leaving out or presupposing a whole background of human values that are sort of centered in human connections and human biology and human empathy, if not some sort of higher, say, categorical imperative or something. And we don't think to state those, for example, that, you know, no human life is worth 100 paper clips, you know. And so I think one worry is that if we sort of program AIs with a single-minded focus to do the thing that we want them to do, how are we making sure that those other human values come along for the ride that are not necessarily always well codified and explicitly stated even among humans? And so there are a few ways to try to do this. One is to ignore it and hope the AI figures it out itself. Another is to actually try to explicitly state what those assumptions are, and I'm doubtful that we're ever going to be able to do that. Ethics is messy and human life is messy. And a third thing is just to try to sort of quarantine the functions of an AI such that we are in control of when it gets used and in the service of which other projects, so that we can make sure that the make all paper clips doesn't override everything else we care about.
And this is where risk reward comes to mind for me, Haley. So if the reward is AI allows us to create machines that could make remarkably efficient paper clips at high quantities.
What else could you want?
And other widgets and hamburger buns and everything else you could want. But the risk is it accidentally wipes out the human race. Is the risk reward really in balance here?
I mean, maybe I want to speak on behalf of some of the computer scientists here and say you're kind of underselling the potential benefits, right? Because another thing it can do in the machine
paper
learning
clips
people,
and hamburger buns, you're right.
And
that's
also
underselling it, yes.
Wading through enormous amounts of data to find things that correlate with cancer or,
absolutely,
you know, manipulate different sort of protein folding things to find new drugs. I mean, there are lots of really, 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 you know, remarkable potential rewards, more than the ones that, say, you know, paper clips have focused on. But if the question is the potential reward worth the risk? I'm not sure that I have a good intuition about it, other than to say the research is going to go forward. And I think that what we can do as ethicists and others who are ethically concerned is just make sure that we are constantly having oversight and explicit statement of what the goals are and what the potential, you know, risks are, and just tracking those and being responsible for them. Because I think it's very easy to sort of ignore one of those variables and only look at the, you know, we only thought about whether we could, we never thought about whether we should. But I think it's also easy to lose track of the potential benefits. For example, if you ask, what good is it to, you know, have a machine that reads lips? Well, unless you're thinking about the deaf community, mm-hmm, it's very easy to sort of, you know, miss out on the ways that sort of these machines can enhance human lives in a very real, on the ground way.
Yeah, as long as they don't accidentally destroy us. And this is where
I think we're going to do it ourselves without much assistance. So, you know,
fair,
I'm not so
fair.
Worried about the computers.
I want to get the other panelists on this in a second. But this is where, Haley, I do think you raise an important point as ethicists, as sort of just observers of the amazing science that's unfolding before us. I think in my very lay, very, very ignorant fashion, that it sort of doesn't matter whether AI can destroy us or not, because we are not going to stop the acquisition of knowledge and the application of knowledge. I don't know how to do it. You know, the whole question of whether we could versus whether we should. If we can make dinosaurs and put them in Jeff Goldblum's Jurassic Park, we're going to. If we can create AI that can read lips or can create paperclips or can cure cancer, we are going to. Mm-hmm. And the question becomes then, if we know we're probably not going to all kind of collude on, let's halt science here,
right.
Then therefore the ethicists have to be in the room.
I think that's right. And I think on, you know, maybe I'm... This is not a popular opinion, but I think it's very, very hard for us to foresee the potential benefits and potential risks of developing technology. And I think there's an argument to be made to say, let the science progress and then constantly have oversight rather than stopping progress right now without being able to anticipate what's going to come down the road. We should deal with the problems as they come up.
Yeah. How do you view it, Chris?
Even if you could halt let me just get this out of the way. There's still a huge, huge, huge gap. Whenever we are talking about AI as AI here, we seem to be thinking about how, but you know, what researchers think about as AI is much more narrow in scope. But with regard to, is it an existential threat? Not right now. Could it be? I'm very skeptical, at least in the long, long term. I mean, just about anything can be an existential threat if we think about it.
But no, this is important. I'm glad to hear that. Why are you skeptical?
I'm skeptical of why people always want to fear the worst. So why? I mean, do we really think that you can specify some function that then it's going to try to optimize, and then we fail to give it our correct? You know, it fails to interpret our intentions correctly. You know, it's like you know, the genie where, you know, you rub the lamp and, you know, you give it a wish and it does whatever you say very explicitly rather than what you actually intend and would desire. So that's the risk we're kind of talking about with like the paperclip maximizer that turns the whole planet and the surroundings as much space as it can into paperclips. I think the positive benefits far outweigh that. And plus, if we did try to stall progress in this space, you would need some sort of... You have two issues to think about. One, will all the other nations stop researching this? I mean, even... So it is...
I doubt it.
Yeah. Russia has said they oppose any treaties to not have weapons that are autonomous. So how would we do that? And two, you can... Researchers and as individuals can do a lot. So how are you going to even police this? Is it going to be like, this guy can't use this computer? I mean, we don't even know how much computational power is required to create something like HAL. So it may be possible that you know, if we have the correct algorithms, we could do this on a computer in the future that somebody could just buy off the shelf. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you could stop just an independent researcher from doing something like this.
Okay.
Well, there would be, you know, again, looking at the films or the literature, there are two other elements here that we haven't really talked about that are embedded, I think, in the literature regarding AIs. One, that because it is created by human beings, it is inherently fallible. That the problems of the creator, and we're back to Frankenstein, sorry, but actually we're back to the Bible, we're back to the tree of knowledge, right? You know, the forbidden fruit and all of that. But one, because the creators of AI are fallible, will that fallibility inevitably fall into the product and the illusion that we can control it? I mean, now we're back to Jurassic Park, I think. And the other big one is, of course, capitalism. The whole idea that these things aren't done in a vacuum. These things are often done to make a profit. And the profit motive is a strong, perhaps, generator that overrides ethics, I think, in our culture. And so those are the things that I think are worrisome that the fictive literature will ask us to consider, I think, mm-hmm. those two things.
Well, and Dennis, maybe he hasn't had the best year PR-wise, but I think it's still interesting to consider what Elon Musk says about this. Mm-hmm. He says, mark my words, AI is far more dangerous than nukes, far. So why do we have no regulatory oversight It's insane. It needs to be a public body that has insight and then oversight to confirm that everyone is developing AI safely. This is extremely important. I think the danger of AI is much greater than the danger of nuclear warheads by a lot, and nobody would suggest that we allow just anyone to build nuclear warheads if they want. Okay. What do you make of that, Dennis?
I think, you know, he's maybe being a little bit reactionary, and I don't know, but I think he raises a good point. Oftentimes, the motivation or sort of the trap that people fall into in making this AI and doing this research is getting the results first and worrying about ethics later. So you see that with Facebook. You know, it's not AI, but they created a network that connects people, and they didn't think about how the ethical implications of that or what it could be used for. And, you know, you talk about profit motive. This year, because of all the controversy surrounding that, you know, their stock has been tumbling. They're really not doing so well. So even that could be potentially used to motivate ethical thinking in developing technology. We're doing work right now at the University of Rochester in the Human-Computer Interaction Lab that involves lie detection. Can you create an algorithm that can detect if someone is lying just by looking at them? And something that we wanted to work on before we get there is think about what are the ethics of that, you know, what are the eventual results that could happen, you know, before we have the algorithm. Can we create it in a way that is ethical, that will minimize harm to the greatest number of people?
Is that achievable? Is that kind of algorithm achievable?
Absolutely.
Before I turn to Haley on this, let's just lean back in his chair. What do you think the ethical implications are?
I mean, lying is something that we do in our daily lives. It benefits us socially.
I don't.
No?
you see what I just did there?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
There are a lot of cases in which lie detection would actually be bad. If you're uncovering something that, you know, would help people if it were concealed. For example, people concealing their sexual orientation, people hiding from the Nazis in World War II. It would be better if certain things were kept private. And a lie detector that's that accurate throws that out the window, especially if it's AI doing it and we don't know how it works.
Well, it's the perfect political era for a machine that can test lies, isn't it?
I'm not going to drag politics into this.
No. It's just a side note. Sorry.
It's a side note from Les. But I take Dennis's point that there is sometimes a social utility for lying, particularly when the truth would put vulnerable people at risk from oppressors. Okay, fair enough. What other ethical implications do you see, Haley? Because what Dennis just gave are extreme examples. Are there more sort of common examples ethically where we need to at least be considering what an algorithm that could detect lying would do?
Absolutely. So before I get to the particular case of lying, I think Dennis brought up something extremely fascinating about these more prosaic cases that I'm actually much more worried about than the far-off sort of possibility of runaway artificial intelligence. So something that Dennis brought up is that these machine learning algorithms are very black box right now. It's very hard to look inside of them and see what they're doing. And I think that coupled with that is this assumption that we see in 2001 that Hal himself expresses, which is that the algorithms themselves are ethically neutral. They're perfect. They're just math. They're not anything, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think when we have this, we think that when we've applied an algorithm to something and it spits out some answer, how could it be doing anything wrong, right? We don't, you know, it's not taking into account any of the things that we, you know, biases we might program in. And I think that's really, 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 really harmful. So you have a lot of sort of real world cases where, and I'm sure that others will attest to this, designing AIs and designing algorithms requires so much human input right now. Even, you know, AlphaGo had a bunch of hand-placed sort of, you know, things to help it learn the rules of Go. So we designed the rules of Go, we gave it the rules, and it played within our rules. And I still think when we're training AIs right now, we are implicitly sometimes giving them a set of rules to play under that is, you know, importing human biases, and they're learning it very, very well, and then spitting out a result that we think is ethically neutral and free of bias. And I don't think that's the case. So Facebook is a good example about how could they be doing anything wrong? They're just setting up the algorithm where, in fact, they're, you know, systematically amplifying some very dangerous biases we have. there are some other cases where, for example, I believe it was Kaplan, the test prep organization, had an algorithm learn how to price some of their services. And it turned out that what it spit out was that they were charging higher prices to certain neighborhoods that had higher concentrations of certain mm-hmm. ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. So basically, you had a sort of racial preference come out of an algorithm, even though no human being thought they were programming it to be racist. But we very subtly build in human sort of, you know, biases into algorithms, and then we ignore them. Whereas if humans are doing them, we're quick to call out bias. So I think in the case of lying, that's another application where my worry is not so much if we've got this perfect lie detector, how do we deal with it? But how are we building these lie detectors that are already, say, programming in a bias about who we think are the people who lie, who are the people that are trustworthy? I think that's a much more insidious effect of AI that's much closer to our lives right now and over the next 20 years. People kept saying, Hal is perfect. Hal is, you know, of course we can't doubt Hal because he's programmed to be absolutely absolutely perfect. And I think we have that attitude towards our AIs now, and it's helpful to be skeptical and poke some holes. Hmm.
In the same way that when we think of what Charles Murray and others have written about IQ tests, as if that is an infallible way of assessing intelligence, right, instead of looking at the decades of advantage and discrimination that have built, you know, these sort of societal differences and then baked them into a possible test. And then we say, well, look at the IQ difference. Same kind of thing, possible creation of algorithm to detect lying.
Exactly. So in our choices of the data sets that you train these AIs on, this choice of data sets can massively, it can overfit to those data sets tremendously. Or which variables we program it in to sort of package data into, the way we give it the data, how we describe the data. I mean, I'm sure, you know, those who work in this field can say I think these are ways that, exactly as you put, as we've designed IQ tests to pick up on some perhaps biases of who we think are intelligent. I think we do that all the time with AIs.
Okay, I'm going to get to your phone calls in a second. I'm sure you've thought about these things before. You know, so you think we can achievably, this is something that's achievable, an algorithm to detect lying, but how can we strip it from some of those biases?
Well, I think what Haley mentioned about the data sets in which you train the algorithm is key. Especially now with computer vision and new algorithms that are being trained, the data matters a lot more, where you're actually looking at people and, you know, people who maybe have different skin colors, if it's like more effective at detecting lies from one rather than the other, then you've already created a bias where, you know, say like law enforcement or someone is using it, suddenly you have a higher rate of, you know, people of this ethnicity are lying, false positives, all sorts of issues that can arise from mm-hmm. that. So it's important to have data sets that are diverse, which is something that right now the field of machine learning is dealing with a problem that is a lack of good data and a lack of available data that is just now starting to be looked at and resolved.
Hmm. Chris, you're right.
It's not intentional. I mean, people are not trying to create these biased algorithms, but data set bias is one of the biggest issues, the hottest issues in this field. Like, how do we resolve this this conundrum? I can give you real world examples of like where this stuff mattered. For example, there was a system that people took to do. This is just a fun example. Not mm-hmm. fun. It's still mm-hmm. going to be racist, but it's what they did was they took they wanted to create a smile detector. Was it a blink detector? One or the other. Before we had, you know, our nice smartphones on a little cubic, you know, little phone, using some AI algorithms. They're very cheap. And so they trained it only on white people. Mm-hmm. And then they used it in Asia, and it utterly failed on this population to correctly detect when they were smiling. And so this is a real-world use case where bias caused some big problems. You know, the thing failed. In the real world, you know, there are like major ethical implications for a lot of these algorithms, which are being used now for things like prison recidivism rates and things like that, to detect whether somebody will commit another crime. And we are now developing algorithms that try to do certain things like have protected groups. So you would say, you know, these people are being discriminated against. We want to make sure that you don't overpredict for black people versus white people or something like that. But to use those algorithms, what you now need to do is feed it in the race of the person. And people don't even like that, you know, because that then, you know, is a clue that you're directly feeding it in. So then you could make it racist by doing that. But then if you don't do that, it could pick up on things are just loosely correlated, like zip codes, which algorithms have done before. We know this. You know, they found, like, as she mentioned, that, you know, it was discriminating against different populations based on their zip codes, which were then correlated with the populations that live in those regions.
Mm. Well, go ahead, Les.
I was going to say, that's what I'm trying to say earlier, and Haley put it better than I put it. These things are have to be a reflection of the frailties and the biases of the people that create them, because we're frail and biased human beings, no? I mean, we can't avoid that. That's one of the lessons that we see in the films over and over. I'm thinking now of a Spielberg film called Minority Report, mm-hmm. in which they essentially try to predict a murder before it happens.
Yeah.
And I won't go into the whole film, but I mean, I think, again, that's one of the issues that the films and the literature says again and again and again and again, that at the center of these creations is a creator who is fallible.
And this is where, by the way, Les, film and literature can do a wonderful job. Look at the conversation we're having today. 50 years since 2001 A Space sure. Odyssey, it is still provoking these conversations.
I agree.
Yeah. Les Friedman, one of our guests here, former chair of the Media and Society Program at Hobart and William Smith College, colleges. Dennis Lomakin, a computer science research assistant, computer research assistant. Boy, oh boy, computer science research assistant at the University of Rochester. I can't read today. Dennis is here. Haley Clatterbuck is here, assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Rochester. And Chris Kanaan is an assistant professor in the Carlson Center for Imaging Science at RIT. It's 50 years since the release of 2001 A Space Odyssey. We're going to take your phone calls on what you're hearing about the past, the present, and the future of AI next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, the indictment of Congressman Chris Collins has thrown that race wide open. You've already heard from the Democrat in the race. There is a third party candidate from the Reform Party. We will sit down with him first hour. In the second hour, the summer of food continues with people who have decided on Rochester. They could have been in New York City or Australia. So why did they choose Rochester? We talked to them. Our guests were just saying during our brief break that the initial audiences 50 years ago to 2001 A Space Odyssey said that HAL, the AI, the super intelligent, the machine intelligence, was the most human character in the film, despite the fact that the AI decided it needed to murder the humans. Really interesting stuff, and maybe a little creepy. And on the subject of some of what we've been hearing from, we got a couple of calls we want to take. We were just talking about lying, and John and Henrietta wants to talk a little bit about that. Go ahead, John.
Yes, I believe it was in the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. He or another one of his books. He talked about the research done by a couple of psychologists over a period of several decades, in which they basically did high-speed videotapes of people and then watched them in slow-mo and started noticing micro-expressions, I think they referred to, and they could actually begin to predict attitudes and behaviors and lying from those. So I don't know if the artificial intelligence research into lying is taking advantage of some of that type of research.
John, thank you. What do we think here, guys? Dennis, you want to hit that?
Well, actually, that is one of the main things that we're looking at is micro-expression. So there's this psychologist, Paul Ekman, who's he's the guy who kind of did all the initial research on micro-expressions. And a big part of his research was also on lie detection, because he believed that there's a strong correlation there. You know, you could have someone say one thing that, you know, maybe indicates that they're sad, but like a little bit of happy emotion flashes across their face just very briefly. And that's, you know, that's something that can clue you in that maybe what they're thinking about isn't really what they're saying. And that's how some of these lie detection algorithms that are being developed now work.
Hmm. John, thank you for the phone call. Keith, next on the phone. I don't know where you're calling from today, Keith, but go ahead.
I'm home today. quick comment. I can understand the fear of AI especially if it's controlling something dramatic, such as nuclear missiles, et cetera, et cetera. But for all intents and purposes, all AI, no matter how smart or how intelligent, it has one weakness, and that's energy. It needs either electricity in the form of direct connection or a battery. So if you fear it, you can unplug it, take the battery out, and it totally becomes dormant. If it starts acting irrationally and it won't let you take the battery out, well, guess what? The battery is going to die eventually, run out.
Well, you've seen the film. You've seen the film, I take it, Keith.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's exactly what ended up happening. And in fact, Keith, thank you, because that's a good segue. The other clip we have is Dave deciding, that's what I'm going to do here. We are going to deprogram this thing. And Hal, the AI, essentially pleads like a human being would plead for its own life. Mm-hmm. This is a scene from the film, 2001 A Space Odyssey, in which Dave is going to try and begins hitting the switches and making the deprogramming with Hal trying to intervene.
I know everything hasn't been quite right with me, but I can assure you now, very confidently, that it's going to be all right again. I feel much better now. I really do. Look, Dave, I can see you're really upset about this. I honestly think you ought to sit down calmly, take a stress pill, and think things over. I know I've made some very poor decisions recently, but I can give you my complete assurance that my work will be back to normal. I've still got the greatest enthusiasm and confidence in the mission, and I want to help you. Dave, stop.
Well, Dave doesn't stop, but this is, to me, I don't know, Chris, this is the part of the film that was the hardest to imagine AI actually communicating in that way. That was very much like a human being pleading for his life.
Right. We're not there yet. So, like, it's kind of a gap between that kind of pleading and that level. Just how would it even learn to do that? So like for like machine learning systems, these things, they have to have this experience to even learn to do that. So it would need to have previously experienced something like this to develop the ability to even do something like that. But it is true that on systems that we have tried to give them, so there's a little toy thing that that a group has been studying where they give the system, there's a little button that the system can walk on and it will turn it off. But then the system can then also learn to go take this circuitous route to disable that button. So that button's basically supposed to be the off button that a human would use. And then many algorithms do learn to disable it just because that's, they want to not be turned off because that impairs their ability to do some work. There's another case that I read about with a robot that stacks boxes, and then sometimes the researcher would interfere with it, and you know it would go out when it went outside. And so instead, what they did was it learned to not go outside, which is they wanted it to go outside, but it learned to not do that just because the human was interfering with it, which messed up its kind of optimization of its total reward it was receiving.
Hmm. You want to add to that, Haley?
Well, I guess I just want to ask you a question, Chris, about something we were talking about earlier. So the caller was asking, we just unplug it. It's just that easy. And I mean, one worry is that if we're putting them in charge of things like the power supply of the ship, if Hal had had full control over what happened on the ship, he would have been able to preserve himself. And I think when we're talking about, some of these algorithms that are being performed on the cloud in a distributed way and someone running it can shift using, CPUs here versus in Singapore or whatever, whether or not it's going to be possible to just shut off the power supply to something. So can you say something encouraging about the ways that we can quarantine these or the ways that we sort of can control their power supply such they're not so widely distributed?
What I can say is that this topic is very of great interest right now, and a lot of people are studying. It's called AI safety. How do you turn it off? It's called the AI control problem. So how do you, if you have a super intelligent AI, and like I said before, we're nowhere there yet. If you have one, though, how are you going to turn it off? you may need to build in some sort of backup system that it cannot disable.
Okay, well, and will it devise its... There's a couple of things here. First of all, just on the filmmaking perspective, Les Friedman, I love that scene because Kubrick decided he didn't need music. Like, just the breathing of Dave as he goes his task with the silence, that was pretty good stuff.
Well, it's fabulous. And you know, in terms of silence, if you think about the film, you realize the first 20 minutes, there's no dialogue, which is a very rare thing.
But it's something like the last 20 minutes, too.
It's the last 20 minutes. But I have a question for Chris, too, and it's really a layman's question, so I'll just ask it. can an algorithm, can AI learn something it hasn't been taught?
It depends. But for a lot of these algorithms that we're currently talking about, these machine learning algorithms, they're not very good at that. I mean, they basically need to have an experience, and then they can generalize from experiences to things, especially if they have enough, you know, experience, you know, with different sorts of similar environments. But, you know, you give it a new environment that's a little bit different, they can generalize just fine. But that generalization has limits. So they can't just learn. It can't just create some new, completely new behavior in the way I think you're imagining, right, using current approaches that the dominant approach right now.
But this is where Michael Benson, writing for The Independent in London, kind of looks at what Hal did and thinks to our own future with AI and says, you know, what if we don't know the answer to that? He writes, maybe one might think Hal could at least be given some overall directives, like be nice to humans or other potential principles of AI ethics. But here's the problem. Given any precise specification, it's inevitable that there will be unintended consequences. One might say these are bugs in the specification, but the problem is they're inevitable. When the computational irreducibility is present, there's basically never any finite specification that can avoid any conceivable unintended consequence. Or, said in terms of the film, it's inevitable that Hal will be capable of exhibiting unexpected behavior. It's just a consequence of being a system that does sophisticated computation. It lets Hal show creativity and take initiative, but it also means Hal's behavior can't ever be completely predicted, end quote. Fair?
It's reasonably fair. So, in fact, the lack of predictability is one reason why. So I used to work at NASA JPL, and they said, you know, we're not going to put any of this AI stuff in space because we want to be able to predict everything it does very, very carefully when billions of dollars are involved. So a lot of this stuff is kind of a little bit difficult to predict and know exactly how it's operating. On the other hand, there are many applications where that might not even matter. For example, a big concern that we talked about earlier was things like, can the AI justify its decisions and explain itself? So if I have a AI that's 99.9% accurate at predicting whether or not you have cancer but can't explain it, would you rather have one that is 95% accurate but can give you an explanation but is 5% wrong about that explanation, mm-hmm, right? I'd take the one that was more likely to save my life.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. And maybe that's a good place to start to close the program, because we want to talk about not just the risks, but, you know, there are, you know, a lot of people very, very sanguine about the future of AI. And we did have Bob in Rochester call to tell us that 2001 A Space Odyssey is playing at IMAX in Gates, if you want to see it on the big screen, which is a cool experience, I'm sure. So thank you for that, Bob. But on the subject of optimism, you know, Dennis, that's some of the work you're doing, is thinking about algorithms and trying to think ethically, but also really effectively at solving problems. What are the problems you think AI can solve for us in the future?
I mean, it's really anything. Any sort of specific task that you have good data for, you can get an AI to do. You know, one of the things about general AI is that it's not always the best at doing specific things. It's like humans. You know, human lie detection, for example, it's about 54% accurate. It's almost equivalent to random chance. And AI could do that much better. And kind of like Chris was saying, there are all these narrow applications for AI in which they can do exceedingly better than humans. For example, reading lips was a good one. When, you know, it's hard for humans to learn that, especially if, you know, they were born deaf or something like that. But any sort of problem that we can get data for and train machines to recognize patterns in that data can be solvable with AI. And there are a lot of those problems that are being solved right now.
Okay. 30 seconds. Are you an optimist?
I'll give you two examples. Yeah. I'm optimistic. So there's two examples. One, we don't have enough physicians to diagnose a lot of diseases, especially in poorer countries. We can use AI to do that. And I actually have a collaboration with a physician at U of R to do some stuff like that, to diagnose diabetic retinopathy automatically. Another case is self-driving cars, who could possibly save millions of lives per year. People, you should not be driving drunk. You know, you may have people who just have impaired whatever abilities, for whatever reason. They can now just take a self-driving car to wherever they want to go. So many, many lives can be saved.
Are you an optimist, Taylor?
I'm an optimist, and I guess one of the things I'm optimistic about is my concerns. I want to understand how humans work. So you ask, can AIs learn something new? And I want to know, how do kids learn something new given the data that they have? It's not like the obelisk touched us and we're magic and AIs aren't. I think one thing AIs can teach us is we can sort of understand how it's possible to learn things from data, and it can shed a lot of light on sort of what we're doing and also shed light on what's so spectacular about us. We're not these limited domain specific kind of things. I think AIs partially show how remarkable humans are.
Great stuff. In 30 seconds less, if we go back and watch 2001 this week, what should we be looking for on the filmmaking side?
Well, I think the Stargate sequence is a classic. And if you think about
that's
it...
That's like a whole other discussion of weirdness.
But yeah, it is. It is. But I think that that's a classic. And I think that it is an amazing sequence given that the state of the technology at that point was semi-primitive. That Kubrick was able to, Trumbull was able to do it. So I think that that was great.
Great having you back. Thanks for being here, Les.
My pleasure.
All right, and we're told, by the way, it's at the IMAX tomorrow through Sunday at IMAX in Gates. Dennis Lomakin, Haley Clatterbuck, Chris Kanaan, thank you so much for your expertise. A great discussion this hour. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Our thanks to Hal, the engineer. Rob. Thank you, Rob. Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson, not the star child. Talk to you tomorrow.